Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, when the circuit court held David and Glenette Notham in contempt, it was demanding that they surrender their Missouri and federal constitutional rights for a scrap of paper signed by an assistant prosecuting attorney, which was not coextensive with those rights. The respondent concedes that both the United States Supreme Court and this court have held that mere use immunity is not coextensive with those rights.
Let me ask you this question. If the state gives immunity, does it give them immunity from federal prosecution?
Your Honor, there is a case, the Murphy case, which deals with a different situation. It deals with a situation involving criminal activity, and it justifies the state giving immunity for federal crimes in a situation where there is a federal and state criminal investigation. This is a completely different situation. It involves a civil matter in which the bank here, Bank of Arizona, is trying to collect the debt. That language is somewhat troubling to me, but I don't think, frankly, it would stop Mike Reif at the U.S. Attorney's Office from prosecuting someone.
There was a case, the Anton case, where John Frank was taken hostage, and the George Peach, the federal said we won't pursue you any further, but then circuit attorney George Peach says that doesn't affect the state case. So, I mean, there are two different jurisdictions. So, like you said, the federal government could still prosecute, and they should be able to still take the Fifth Amendment.
Your Honor, I agree with your conclusion. I was just trying to be clear on the record that there is a case which give us some problems.
Who decided Murphy?
The United States Supreme Court.
So they have said that a prosecutor in either state or federal can give full transactional immunity for, and it would apply across jurisdictions?
Yes, Your Honor, I think you're correct. The distinction I'm making is...
I understand here you're saying regardless it was just use immunity.
Yes, but I'm also saying in the Murphy case, I'm saying there is a distinction in that case because if you look at the reason for giving that dual use, it's because of the global goal of criminal enforcement. Here it's not the same. It's being used to try to help a bank collect the judgment. So I would say for policy reasons it wouldn't apply. But yes, I understand that's a problem to us, but we're not really relying on that in this case. And I would say that the respondent does concede that the Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have held that mere use immunity isn't good enough. And it defends...
But the user language of use, but it really sounds like transactional. When you read the statute, it almost sounds like transactional, but the term is use immunity, not transactional.
Your Honor, the statute is denominated grant of use immunity. It uses the term use immunity three times. The Castigar case by the U.S. Supreme Court is the case which holds that immunity can supplant a federal constitutional and, I guess, state constitutional right. In the 20 years between the time that Castigar was decided and this statute was passed, the term use immunity, the lowest kind, derivative immunity, let's call that the medium kind, and transactional, the ultimate immunity, became terms of art. I'd also point out to the court that, as Judge Richter said in the opinion below, the legislature knows how to determine how to say transactional immunity. The court referred to the numerous occasions where the legislature has specifically granted that immunity. One of those statutes, RSMO 622390, was enacted in 1996. 3 years after the statute in question here used the term use immunity three times. That statute's language and the other four cited by the court below states that no person shall be prosecuted, punished, or subjected to any penalty, forfeiture, or on account of any act, transaction, matter, or thing concerning which the person shall have been examined while under oath. That language is so different from the language in the statute here today that it's clear the legislature knows how to grant transactional immunity.
Your opponent argues that if we interpret the statute as you argue, then the statute has no use and has no purpose because it serves no purpose if it doesn't grant sufficient immunity to offset the right to remain silent.
I understand that argument, Your Honor, but some people might be happy with mere use immunity.
Well, it exists. Clearly, it's offered in some cases.
It's offered in some cases. So some people might be satisfied with use immunity. And I'd also point out, in the 20 years since this statute was pointed out, it seems to me that a lot of people seem to be satisfied with use immunity. The statute says use immunity. And
if I understand other parts of your argument correctly, prosecutors have no authority to grant immunity except as granted by statute. So, because here it seems like the prosecutor was saying, I'm intending to grant transactional immunity, but they wouldn't have any greater authority than the statute allows them.
Yes, Your Honor. In Munn versus McKelvey, you held that the prosecutor in Missouri has no inherent right to grant immunity. It must stem from a statute. So really, what we're looking at is this statute. What we're looking at is this statute.
How would you write the language, shall protect such person from prosecution for any offense related to the content of the statements made?
That the statement can't be used to prosecute them.
That would be used. And how about if you were trying to do a clear transactional immunity?
I would use the language that's set out by the legislature in 622.390, where it uses the word transaction. The word transaction is not used. Your Honors?
Everything arising out of the transaction as opposed to the statements.
Right. Okay. That's correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, I think this case is relatively simple. And I was trying to, frankly, explain this case to my grandson, Isaac Wijia. And in the simplest possible terms, I said to him, remember Dr. Seuss's Horton the Elephant? He said, I meant what I said, and I said what I meant.
How old is your grandson?
He's 7, but he's very smart, Your Honor. And I told him I'd mention his name here today. The legislature said what it meant and meant what it said. This is a problem for the legislature. If the legislature wants to grant transactional immunity, which is a very serious thing, as pointed out by the court below in its third footnote, does it really want an assistant prosecuting attorney handing things out like a 10-day letter? It needs to act specifically. This is not a policy question for this court to deal with. The court dealt with those issues and responded in Fisher versus Frictel, reminding parties that policy issues are for the legislature. This is something, even if the court were to find the statute was somewhat ambiguous, even if it found that, the burden should be on the other side to show the exact meaning of the statute. And with the word use being used 3 times in the statute, it's difficult to see what the legislature meant. We're also at a disadvantage in this case because, unlike when one tries to figure out what a statute meant, in the federal government, we have long legislative history. We don't know what happened here. No one can really say what the legislature meant. So the answer for the Bank of Arizona is very simple. If they don't like this law, they should go across the street, they should get their lobbyists to try to pass a bill, and they should try to give people full transactional immunity. So that when lawyers like me are in a position to advise their clients as to whether they've been given full transactional immunity and are prohibited, are not going to be prosecuted by the federal government, by the state government, and we haven't even mentioned the state of Arizona, because even the Murphy case doesn't protect these people from being prosecuted by the state of Arizona.
What's the immunity laws in Arizona?
Your Honor, I don't know what the immunity law is in Arizona, but I know that
state prosecutor in Missouri cannot protect him from Arizona.
That's exactly my point. This court in the Cloyd case in 1981 simply held that the burden is on the other side to show that an answer can't incriminate someone. We've got an immunity letter. It doesn't supplant that. And basically we're saying that the legislature needs to answer that. And in my final minute here, I simply want to ask the court to grant the writ that the Court of Appeals twice granted provisionally and permanently, and issue its own writ preventing the circuit court from holding my clients in contempt. And unless there are any questions, I'll yield the rest of my time except for my 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel, could I get you to expand a bit? You said something to the general effect, I think, that you didn't feel the Murphy case would protect where there was immunity if you had two states involved. Is that your thoughts that you're reading in the Murphy case?
I don't see how the Murphy case could possibly. It doesn't deal with two states. We have a federal system, and I can see how the U.S. Supreme Court could say, yes, we'll be bound by what you say. But in a federal system, each state has its own rights. I don't see how any court, no matter how liberal or conservative, could say, well, the state of Arizona is bound by something that an assistant prosecuting attorney has done in the state of Missouri. There's no logic or reason, and no case I can imagine which stands for that.
Thank you, Judge.
If there are no other questions, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pressman. District Pearson.
May it please the court. Good morning.
Again, I'm Jeff McPherson, and I represent Arizona Bank and Trust, and it's my special honor and privilege this morning to appear in support of Judge Walsh. If I could work from back to front, there was some discussion of Arizona law right at the end of Mr. Pressman's presentation, the very first mention of Arizona law at any point in the history of this case. I'll note for the record that the debtors objected to interrogatories directed to them to find the assets from which this judgment can be satisfied. That appears in our appendix to our brief at page 74. No mention of Arizona law, only objections based on the Fifth Amendment and Missouri law. Direct the court's attention to the hearings at which the debtors were questioned. They raised the Fifth Amendment and the Missouri Constitution, never raised the Arizona.
So let's get to Missouri law. It says use immunity. It says the title is unsatisfied judgment, examination of debtor, use immunity. Repeated use immunity through it. But you said we should interpret that to mean transactional immunity.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the court should interpret the statute according to its plain terms, giving, as the court has said so many times, every word meaning, not reading one word or phrase in isolation.
What meaning are you giving to use?
Well, Your Honor, I'm giving it the meaning, and it wouldn't be me giving it any meaning, obviously, Your Honor. It would be the court. The meaning that the legislature said that it should have. The argument from the debtors ignores the second sentence of subsection 2. They say, look at use immunity. We know what use immunity is. But the legislature specified what this use immunity means. And they say such use immunity, meaning this use immunity from prosecution, shall protect such person from prosecution for any offense related to the content of the statements made.
Well, it doesn't
made.
Say related to the transaction, though. I can see where you might get information from a statement that then would lead to other information, and you'd use the other information, not the content of the statement. And not to parse it out, but if they know how to say what they – why didn't they just say that? Why didn't they amend it? It was an early statute, but it was amended as late as 93, yet that language was left in.
It was amended in 1993 for this purpose, Your Honor. After the Munn case, after the other cases that the debtors would like the court to rely on to say that there is not adequate immunity here. How can it be that the legislature, with full knowledge of Castigar
and Munn, what exactly did that amendment do to the prior version of the statute?
The prior version of the statute was just the subsection 1, Your Honor. Subsection 1 allowing for the judgment debtor exam after you had made efforts to execute and the executions had been returned unsatisfied, as was done in this case. And so the evident purpose, then, is to effectuate the ability of a creditor to go after these assets, and by making the debtor testify about this, and the debtor benefits. The effect of subsection 2 is for the debtor to be off the hook for anything, Your Honor.
But we can't, the trial court can't, and the prosecutor can't give greater immunity than the statute permits it to give. And it clearly says use immunity. Are you telling me the concepts of the distinction between use and transactional immunity did not exist as early as 1993? Did those concepts diverge after that point, or did the distinction between them exist prior to that time?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor, of course. The Castigar and other cases existed prior to 1993, obviously.
Just addressing also, my other concern is that you basically say there's no purpose to use immunity, that it would then not give anything if we interpreted it as meaning use rather than transactional immunity. The statute would be pointless because you wouldn't really get anything for it. But are you saying prosecutors never successfully offer use immunity and that's not taken?
Your Honor, I
all those CSIs are wrong?
I don't know about those, Your Honor. All I know is about the record that's before the court in this case, and I can't speculate about what happens in other cases. Is it possible
part of your argument. Okay.
Is it possible that a prosecutor could give use immunity and that someone might be satisfied by that? I guess it's possible, Your Honor. But what the cases say
Wasn't your argument that it's pointless because it's worthless? But you're saying now? I thought your argument was we can't interpret it as meaning just use immunity, because otherwise there would have been no point to having the statute.
That is what I'm saying, Your Honor.
And so then it begs the question, is use immunity used and is it effective? Do prosecutors take advantage of it?
And my answer to that, Your Honor, would be, is it possible that a prosecutor could offer someone use immunity and that someone might be satisfied by it? Sure. But would that be an effective statutory grant of immunity that would comply with Castigar and Munn in the cases? No, it would not. If this said it's only use immunity, and if the court takes a look at the Keithley case, I suppose, or the Kirtley, I apologize, case, the Kirtley case demonstrates that. If you just give somebody partial immunity, if you give the Heidelberg case, if you give someone immunity that cuts off at a particular time, well, that's not going to satisfy the requirement of giving someone immunity that would be effective to substitute for their constitutional rights. But in this statute, they don't do that. There's no time limit. There's no cutoff. It's not restricted to any particular cause of action. It says any offense related to the content of the statements. So the statements have some content. Anything related to that content, you're off the hook for it. You're not off the hook for the use of the statement. You're off the hook for prosecution for any offense. Now, the statement.
The language of the statute, it uses the term use immunity, and it doesn't use the term derivative use immunity that the U.S. Supreme Court used. But isn't the language defining it as use immunity broad enough to cover derivative use immunity?
Oh, Your Honor, it is certainly broad enough to cover derivative use immunity. It goes beyond that. It confers transactional immunity.
If we disagree with you and it doesn't, would you clarify for me? The U.S. Supreme Court has requires transactional immunity?
It requires at least derivative use immunity.
So it doesn't require transactional
immunity? No, it doesn't. This provides more protection than is required.
What is there a difference between transactional use immunity and derivative use immunity? I mean, transactional immunity and derivative use?
There sure is, and it took me a long time to get that straight in my head, so I'm glad you asked. Use immunity means I can't use, if I'm the prosecutor, I can't use the statement. I did X. That can't be used against you. Derivative use immunity means that the prosecutor can't use I use X and then investigate the admission of X, or I went with Tony to go ask Tony, and et cetera. And then transactional immunity covers the entire subject of what the testimony
was. If they committed any crime about that subject, then they would be immune. But
Yes. But
use immunity is only the statement. Derivative is using information from the statement to obtain other evidence that also can't be used.
Exactly.
So to comply with the Supreme Court requirement, the immunity to give up a Fifth Amendment right, the immunity only has to be use and derivative use immunity.
Exactly.
And even if we don't accept your argument that it is transactional immunity granted by the statute, it clearly covers use, and the question would be whether it covers derivative use.
Exactly, Your Honor, and it surely does. And let me say, this is not, if this subsection 2 had only maybe the first sentence of subsection 2, I would think the debtors would have something to talk about here. But it has the second sentence, and it says such use immunity. And by such use immunity, it means this use immunity. It doesn't purport to be a statutory definition of use immunity for all purposes in all statutes in all cases, but it says such use immunity, this use immunity, lets you off the hook for prosecution for any offense related to the content of the statements. That goes way beyond use immunity. And the way I know that is that in the debtor's briefs before the court, they haven't addressed subsection 2. What does it mean? They haven't told the court what it means, because its meaning is pretty clear. I would think Isaac sounds like a very bright boy. He would understand the court's standards for statutory construction and know that every word has to mean something, certainly an entire sentence in a statutory enactment has to mean something.
Is the law of Isaac?
It's been the law of this court, and I would think that Isaac is subject to it.
Does not the word use have to have some meaning also?
Sure, absolutely, Your Honor. And it does.
And what is the meaning of it then?
And use immunity alone, and this does include use immunity. They can't use the statement. But it all goes on to say that in not using the statement, that you're immune from prosecution for any crime related to it. And so it is use immunity plus. It's use immunity extended to transactional immunity.
If the statute only focuses on the term use and never ever refers to the words derivative or transactional, aren't we limited to the word use?
Oh, well, Your Honor, the cases cited by the Court of Appeals, the cases cited by the debtors, the Farmacal case, the Gash against Lafayette County, all of those say that this court, in construing the statute, gives meaning to every word, that the court doesn't look to any word or phrase in isolation, that the statute as a whole has to be considered. And so I agree, you can't read use out of the statute, but you surely have to read it in the context of the entire statute.
And how does that make you read use as transaction? We can't read it as saying, we can't read green as red, even if we think that must be what logically they should have said there.
Oh, well, Your Honor, certainly sometimes shall means may, sometimes may means shall. But I'm not asking the court to read use as anything other than use. But what I'm saying is that the court provided a statutory definition of the extent of this use immunity, of such use immunity as used in this statute.
Explain to me again why that's important. Why is it important that it be transactional immunity versus use that includes derivative use?
Because that is a substitute for the constitutional rights that the debtors are asserting. The law provides that everybody, you and I, have constitutional rights against self-incrimination. Those are important.
And isn't that all that's needed to require them to testify?
Yes. You either have to honor the right or provide a substitute for it, or the other thing you can do is show that.
And use and derivative use immunity provides that substitute.
It does.
So why are we arguing whether it also covers transactional immunity?
Because, Your Honor, I believe on its face that's what the statute does, but you're correct, it needn't go that far. To address a couple of the other things, Judge Stith, you in talking with Mr. Pressman, you noted that the prosecutor can't specify the extent of the immunity. I agree with that.
Beyond what's permitted by statute.
The statute specifies it. It's not, that is not something that the prosecutor can say. And this is on a point that wasn't raised by Mr. Pressman, but I will note that in connection with their point three, they raise an issue as to whether the assistant prosecutor can do this. This grant of immunity that Mr. Pressman was waving around explicitly is in the name of the prosecuting attorney. Comes now the prosecuting attorney of the 21st Judicial Circuit, et cetera, and it's signed by his deputy. That is, according to the authorities we cited in our brief, entirely adequate.
I also wanted to ask you about point two, about whether or not specific findings need to be made after each question. You know, is there any authority for that? I mean, I realize that he's quoting from an earlier order of the court, but is there magical language that has to be used?
Your Honor, the only magical language came from the opinion that transferred that case to this court. It's in Notham 2 for the first time that there appears to be a direction to the circuit court to make a finding after each question.
Well, if this court were to interpret the prior remand to require that, then would we have to send it back down?
Well, if the court did that, the court would have to read that into Notham 1.
Well, if the court read it as requiring that, and that's why it was sent back down, because those findings hadn't been made, what is your reason why that doesn't require us to send it back again?
And I apologize, Your Honor. I mean, I don't understand the
question.
The court
clearly did not make findings as to each question or even have the questions asked. I read your brief as saying, although you're not saying it now, that because it found that full transactional immunity was granted, it doesn't need to go into those because nothing could incriminate them. But if we were to disagree with that, then there was no question and answer given. We don't know if each question would have incriminated or not. Don't we have to send it back down for him to make an individualized determination?
Your Honor, as of NOFM 1, the record was not complete as to what the questions and answers were. Now the record is after NOFM 1, it was the order was quashed, proceedings continued, the hearing on May 3 of 2011, and the questions start appearing on page 2. There are 9 questions that were asked of each of the debtors, 9 answers, each of which was, I invoke my rights under the Missouri and federal constitutions. And so those questions and answers are in the record. The court made explicit findings, not as to question 1, question 2, question 9, but in the transcript of October 4, 2011, on page 31, makes an explicit statement. I find that in the particular context of those questions, that you do not stand that you have full immunity. The court says, page 33, you've been granted full immunity. Page 34, page 36, the court makes explicit statements to that effect. The court also entered a written order in addition to the oral pronouncement.
The trial court's finding was that they were granted, quote, full immunity? Was that
yes.
Actually?
Yes, mm-hmm. Your Honor.
So full immunity would still be limited by what the terms of the statute are interpreted to mean?
And I will commend that to the court's attention to the pages cited, but mm-hmm. It is plain that the court is saying that you have full transactional immunity.
Right. That's what the trial court thought. But it would not require remand for this court to determine what full immunity meant, if it meant derivative immunity or somewhere in between based upon the language of the statute.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the record is such as to require any remand for that purpose. And if I could also just further answer your question, Judge Stith, attached to the writ petition that's before the court now, pages 18 and 19, for one of the debtors, the court makes the explicit findings. And so I believe the record is replete with the findings of the circuit court. Now, the idea that there's any requirement to make a specific separate finding as to each question, that has appeared nowhere before NOFM 2, respectfully, as to the Court of Appeals, that statement is not in NOFM 1. And for those reasons, we would ask that the writ petition be denied and that the preliminary writ of prohibition be quashed. Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Your Honors, there's been a question raised about the breadth of the immunity. Missouri law, as held by this court in Ex parte Carter, is broader under the Missouri Constitution, Article 1, Section 19. In 1902, and it's still good law, you held, no statute which leaves the party or witness subject to prosecution after he answers the incriminating question put to him can have the effect of supplanting the privilege conferred by the Constitution. In view of the constitutional provision, a statutory enactment to be invalid must afford absolute immunity against future prosecution for the offense to which the question relates. I agree that the Supreme Court's opinion says that only derivative immunity is needed. My opponent is right. But the law in this state goes further than that. The second question I'd like to deal with is really the sideshow, and let me try to make the court's job a little bit easier. I, in preparing for this argument, was a little bit confused myself about the failure of the trial court to make the specific findings. I think it's fair to say that if the immunity is good, it supplants those findings. So what we're really talking about here is, did the Nothams get full immunity? And finally, on the subject of the Arizona matter, my clients invoked their rights under the Missouri Constitution and the federal Constitution because it was the state of Missouri in the located in the United States.
It wouldn't do much good to as for your rights under the Arizona Constitution.
That's my point. But it's still, those forcing me to answer, forcing them to answer, it could still subject the prosecution there. So I think that's a red herring. I've admitted our little red herring. I think that one's a red herring, too.
I'm sorry.
Does the Missouri constitutional language regarding the right against self-incrimination, are those mirror image provisions with the federal constitution?
The language is similar, but this court has held that the Missouri Constitution
back then there wouldn't have been three types of immunity.
No.
So it's hard to say that holding would necessarily bind this court. I mean, are you aware of really any provisions where the mirror image, where we don't apply a doctrine, where we accept the United States Supreme Court's cases as precedent when the language is the same?
No, the only thing I would just repeat that this court has said that the Missouri, in Cloyd and other matters, has said that the Missouri provision is broader than the federal constitution under Article 1, Section 19.
Can you address the use of the word use immunity, and do you agree with opposing counsel that would include derivative use immunity?
No, I wouldn't, Your Honor. It simply using that language in the face of the word use three times means that you have to throw away the word use.
Or we'd have to add in a word derivative use, you're saying?
You'd have to add in the word derivative use. And again, I say, Your Honors, even if the basic rule of constitutional construction is, statutory construction is, if it's not ambiguous, you just read the words.
Is the language at the end of the statute broader than the term use? The last phrase?
I'd have to concede, Your Honor, it's at least a little bit confusing. So if someone wanted to use that as an open the door to try to manufacture an ambiguity, then I think you could do that. Again, I'll make a quote of an attorney who has appeared many times before this court, Mr. Arnold, who says, just because I call my dog an investment contract doesn't make it. So I don't think just saying this statute is ambiguous makes it. But even if it is, Your Honors, I think the question here is, in a situation of this importance involving constitutional rights, when the legislature is just across the street, even a tie, which I don't think here, should go to us. And unless there are any other questions, I ask that the court issue its writ, and thank you very much.
Thank you. The case will be taken under submission.